This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and I know it's lunchtime for many of you, so we're going to talk a bit about the stories behind some of the things that might be on your plate. Fried chicken, yams, greens, mac and cheese, and if you're lucky, some delicious banana pudding. All elements of a typical plate of soul food. And my guest today has spent years researching these dishes. He's looked at how they got onto the soul food plate and what they mean for African-American culture. Adrian Miller calls himself a recovering lawyer and politician turned soul food scholar. He's based in Colorado, but he's in North Carolina today and joins us on the State of Things. Adrian Miller, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to break cornbread with you.
Oh, it is so good to have you here. And this book is just full of yummy stuff that I'll start making as soon as I get off the air. But you came to this whole issue kind of in a roundabout way as a lawyer and politician.
Right. So practicing law was not the thing for me. I guess the clue was I was singing spirituals in my office, so I figured I needed to do something else. So I had a stint in the Clinton White House on something called the Initiative for One America. It was a racial, ethnic, and religious reconciliation thing. And then in between that and going back to Colorado, I was trying to get back, I picked up John Edgerton's book, Southern Food, At Home, On the Road, in History. And in that book, he said the tribute to the achievement of African Americans in cookery has yet to be written. And I emailed him and I said, I'm sure somebody's taken on this story. And he's like, no, people have taken on parts of it, but not the whole story. So with no qualifications at all, except for eating this food a lot and cooking it some, I dove in.
Where is the tribute lacking? I mean, we certainly, this phrase soul food is certainly associated with African-American foodways and its long connection with the South. What's missing in all of that?
Well, I think it's just some adoration for the cuisine. I think there are two really strong critiques of soul food. One is that it needs a warning label. The idea that if you eat this food on a regular basis, it's going to kill you. And the second, which is stronger within the African-American community, is that this is slave food, not worthy of celebration. And I looked around and I saw all of these other ethnic cuisines being celebrated. And I thought, why not soul food?
And is it, I mean, so let's take that first critique, needs a warning label, this stuff will kill you. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, part of it is true. This is because I'm trying to get people to reimagine soul food. And soul food is really the celebration food of the South. And I try to get people to think about soul food as an immigrant cuisine. It's what the black migrants who left the rural South took to other parts of the country. And if you look at any other immigrant cuisine in this country, it's usually the celebration food of the old country. And that's what soul food is. So the things like fried chicken, the glorious cakes, cobblers, all of that stuff, that was once in a while food, yeah. Special occasion food. But as people prosper, you know, they remember the good life. And so they start to recreate home by celebrating the good life a little more often than every once in a while.
Because they can, yeah.
Right.
Well, which almost gets to the second critique. It is not the everyday stuff of enslaved communities.
No, and one of the biggest takeaways from my research is that if you actually look at what people are eating throughout Southern history, it's really more about place and class than race. Blacks and whites of the same socioeconomic status were pretty much eating the same foods.
Which gets to the other question of, isn't soul food just Southern food?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think soul food is more about what African Americans are eating outside the South. Now, when you get within the South, the lines between Southern and soul are pretty blurred. But I think there you can draw out some distinctions. I think soul food is more intense. It's going to be spicier, maybe sweeter, have more fat, all these other things. A great example is Nashville hot chicken, which is now becoming a crossover dish. It's a type of fried chicken that's just fiery hot, right? But that comes out of the soul food tradition. So I think even though there's a common heritage, you know, you can differentiate it.
And when you talked about it being an immigrant food or an emigrant food in some ways, I mean, that's an interesting point, is that this is the food we took with us. And that usually suggests that once you come in contact with the other cultures up north and in the Northeast, particular Midwest, that's where some of the changes take place. Did you find that?
Absolutely. So one thing is just the embrace of noodles, for instance, from spaghetti with the Italians that they lived with in certain urban centers. Because a lot of cities in the north, you had pretty much blacks with other recent immigrants living very close to each other. So you see a lot of spaghetti houses. You see a lot of Chinese restaurants in black neighborhoods. And so these dishes start to get embraced. One example of a Chinese dish embraced is something called yak mein. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's a noodle dish with a lot of assorted meats in it that you start seeing in a lot of African-American places, especially New Orleans and along the South. So, yeah.
I wonder about the you know, Buffalo, New York, where I'm from, is famous for a thing called chicken wings.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think few people understand. There's a place called the Anchor Bar that was made famous, I think, in the pages of the New Yorker. Chicken wings, barbecue chicken wings, were soul food. And,
yeah.
And when I grew up not eating them at the Anchor Bar because they didn't have them yet.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have to go to the east side of Buffalo to some soul food restaurants where I first had chicken wings. And then Italian Americans always were taking over everything they found in African American neighborhoods. Sure, soon enough, it became famous for the city of Buffalo.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because the famous food writer Calvin Trillin did an essay on this, and he talked about a guy, I think his name was John Young, who was selling chicken wings with something he called Mambo sauce, which was a spicy sauce. And now, I'm sure the Bellissimos with the Inca Bar are a beautiful family, but when you have two different creation stories within the same family, you know, you start to wonder.
Yeah, well, that's how they made the Bible. Two different creation stories there. That's a story for another day. So tell us about your research, because what a cool project to have to do research on, huh?
Yeah, so a lot of my research came out of reading old cookbooks, talking to people, my elders, other African-Americans around the country, and then old newspapers. A lot of companies are digitizing these sources, so you can search documents in the 1700s. But the most fun I had was eating my way through the country. I went to 150 soul food restaurants in 35 cities and 15 states.
And you're alive to tell about it.
Yeah, yeah. You look surprised that I'm alive.
I mean, I want to do get back to that because you talked about it being celebration food. The fact is, I mean, if we're talking about fried chicken and some of the other things, and even greens that are sort of cooked in various fats and oils, I mean, if you eat this stuff every day, it can have some
right.
kind of health
problems, yeah.
right?
But here's the interesting twist on that. If you look at what nutritionists are telling us to eat, dark leafy greens, sweet potatoes, legumes, fish, those are the building blocks of soul food. So what I'm trying to get people to do is like, okay, the glorious stuff, just have it once in a while, but there's still a heritage here of vegetables, good eating, and it can be healthy food. Okra, you know, a lot of soul foods are being identified as superfoods now. You know, you've seen what happened to kale over the last 10 years,
yeah.
right? Now okra is coming up on the scene, so.
There are actually more T-shirts promoting kale than GOP presidential candidates, which is an astounding number.
Yeah, just because of its long tradition in soul food, I tell people, if you're eating kale now, welcome to the party because we've been eating it for about 300 years.
And talk about how many of those traditions were actually brought over from West Africa and how many were adaptations once the African Americans found themselves here.
Yeah, a couple of quick examples are eating dark leafy greens. That is very central to West African cooking. And even though you see it in other parts of the world, it's no surprise to me that it flourished in the South. Another thing is seasoning those greens with some kind of meat. Now, in West Africa, they weren't using pork. They were using fish that was either salted, dried, or smoked to create that flavor profile. So you can see these immigrants coming across the Atlantic, you know, forced immigration, settling in a new place, trying to recreate home. They couldn't get the fish maybe that they had back home, but they would use pork to create a similar flavor. So that's something you see as well.
You mentioned okra, but you say that fried okra really would not be – you wouldn't consider it a soul food.
No, I wouldn't. I think of okra and its slimy gloriousness, right, with some tomatoes or something like that. But you're seeing okra as a bar food now. So it's popping up all over the place. And more recently, you're seeing dried okra called okra chips starting to pop up in different restaurants.
May soon replace kale as our number one T-shirt item. And then some of the other stories, like the story of chicken and waffles, the origin of chicken and waffles.
Yeah, so that's the one that's hard pill to swallow because a lot of people believe that it started in Harlem in the jazz era because you have people coming out of the clubs at 3 in the morning, too late for dinner, too early for breakfast. So this guy named Joseph Wells created this hybrid dish to satisfy that combo of hunger. A lot of this is attributable to his marketing genius because chicken and waffles actually comes from old Europe. It's the German immigrants who settled in the Pennsylvania countryside. We call them Pennsylvania Dutch, but it's really Deutsch. They brought a creamed chicken and waffle tradition with them. So it takes root in the countryside. Then it goes to Philadelphia where it becomes upscale. And there was a lot of intermarriage between wealthy Philadelphia families and wealthy Southern families. And so the dish comes south and becomes fried chicken and waffles. So that was a combo that even Thomas Jefferson was serving. To entertain guests. And it enters the black tradition because you had often enslaved African Americans doing the cooking in the big house. It's a wealthy person's dish for about 100 years, then it kind of falls out of favor, and then it's in black culture for another 8 decades. And then in the late 90s, it just starts to cross over all over the place. So I tell my African American friends, because they thought that chicken waffles was another thing that white people stole from us, just like blues and rock
and roll. Chicken wings.
Yeah, and I said, nope. We stole it first. It's just going back home.
Well, I think when it comes to food, trying to lay claim is a pretty tricky proposition.
Yeah, because right? there's a lot of borrowing, and it's a tribute, right? You taste something that tastes good, you bring it into your culture, and a lot of this stuff was not documented. So I'm very uncomfortable saying that this person or group of people did this first, unless there's clear evidence.
Let's also look at the phenomenon of red drinks.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
All right. So you have to understand, in soul food nomenclature, red is not only a color, it's a flavor. So we don't call things cherry or strawberry or has hints of cranberry. It's just red. There are actually two ancestral red drinks that crossed the Atlantic that most people have had and probably didn't know it. Cola because kola nuts are white or red, and there's a hospital, you know, sign of hospitality, you would offer people kola nuts to chew, or you would give them a kola nut tea to drink. And then hibiscus. If you've been in the Caribbean, it's also called sorrel. And I don't know to what extent taquerias are popular in Chapel Hill. I think they're probably
pretty big, yeah.
Yeah, if you go get agua de Jamaica, which is translated as Jamaica water, it's hibiscus tea. And hibiscus is native to West Africa, and you use the flower petals to create this red tea. And it's the same formula as red Kool-Aid, because I believe red Kool-Aid is the official soul food drink. You get some water, color it red, sweeten it to taste.
Well, you make this point in the book, and you say that it's about red, and with apologies to Alice Walker, as you say, it is not about the color purple. It's about the color red, though Dave Chappelle did do a great segment on naming the drink not by its flavor, but by its color. Let's listen.
Remember that commercial for Sunny Delight when all the kids run in from outside playing, and they all run to the fridge? All right. I got some purple stuff, some Sunny D. As soon as you say Sunny D, all the kids go, yeah! Watch the black kid in the back. If you ever see that commercial again, look at that black kid. He'd be like, I want that purple stuff. That's drink. That is drink. They want drink. They want all them vitamins. I want drink. Sugar, water, purple. That's the ingredient, sugar, water, and of course, purple.
Dave Chappelle from The Chappelle Show on colored drinks, one of the topics that is part of a typical soul food meal and documented in Soul Food, the surprising story of American cuisine, one plate at a time. Adrian Miller is the author, and he's with me today. But that is a part of the phenomenon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But there is a generational shift happening. So old school guys like me like red drink, but the youngins coming up, I mean, Dave Chappelle caught that vibe. They're into purple. And I say this in my book. You know, I believe the children are our future, that we should teach them well and let them lead the way, but not on drinks. They're messing it up.
Straight no. So it's like pull up your pants and call it red.
Yeah.
You got two things going for you about the kids. Mac and cheese. What a revelation here.
Mm-hmm. So mac and cheese is something that started out as royalty food in the 1300s. The go-to cookbook for the royal court of Queen Elizabeth I has a mac and cheese recipe. Now, the earliest version was essentially the pasta with some Parmesan cheese grated on it. Over time, the eggs and milk get added. So it goes from being a royalty dish to a wealthy person's dish. Thomas Jefferson and other wealthy Americans go to Europe. They experience the dish, bring it back with them. And you see a lot of Southern manuscript cookbooks have a recipe called macaroni pudding. It's essentially what we call macaroni and cheese. The thing that's interesting, and it's the same story as chicken and waffles. You've got it served in the big house. African-American cooks are the ones making it. It comes into African-American culture. So much so that there are older African-Americans today that believe that we invented macaroni and cheese, mm-hmm. and it's been stolen and appropriated by other people. And, you know, I have to tell them, no, that's not the case.
Well, and I was surprised to learn that Thomas Jefferson was such a maniac about he brought he got a pasta machine, right?
Yeah. You're really being kind to him because he actually had it smuggled out of Italy because the Italians had pasta making on lockdown. So he had went to some great lengths to have an aide of his get this pasta maker back to the United States. And there's actually a schematic of it because, you know, Jefferson was a very curious guy. In the Library of Congress, there's actually a drawing of it. And he broke down the pasta maker and served it in the White House.
You know, this led to some curiosity about the Yankee Doodle song, which is just stuck a feather in his head and called it macaroni. And then I began to think, wonder. Turns out, not at all. It turns out, this has nothing to do with your book, but you must endure this now. It turns out that was a British song. They were mocking the colonists. Doodle was from a German word, meant idiot, moron. And Yankee Doodle, I mean, he put a feather in his hat, thought it was macaroni, which makes reference to some effeminate group of fashionista in the 18th century who wore macaroni hats. And called themselves macaronis.
Okay.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting about this is that this food, identifiably part of Italian cuisine, was popular before Italians really showed up in large numbers in this country. Because the biggest Italian migration, and they were here from the get-go, but the biggest migration was in the 1880s. But macaroni and cheese is popular before.
And as we know, we Italians stole it from the Chinese. Sorry, I'm trying to give credit where credit's due here. I know, but all my Italian-American friends now have just filled my inbox. What are the big surprises for you?
Big surprise was to the extent that soul food is not really a term commonly used in the South. People in the South are more likely to call it home-style cooking, home cooking, or country cooking. And that led me to this idea that I think it's more about what African Americans are eating outside the South. One I already shared earlier is just the commonality of soul food. I found that, you know, there were Southern whites eating chitlins with gusto up until the 1950s. And, you know, chitlins, you know, that's one of the most controversial soul food items. And that buys into the narrative that this is throwaway food, you know. And that's not the case. And that chitlins used to be rich people's food.
They were
eaten well.
And I guess the fact that it's the end product is it gives rise to the idea that only the poorest people would be eating it.
Yeah.
But you're saying it was on everybody's table.
Yep. And the other big takeaway is that if you look at the current soul food scene, vegan and vegetarian is the hot trend. I went to a place in Oakland, California called Solely Vegan, where I had southern fried tofu, vegan mac and cheese, and vegan collard greens. And that's the hot trend.
Wait a minute, but the question is, how was it? I mean, seriously.
You know what? The southern fried tofu was shaped to look like fried chicken. I'll show you a picture of this. It tasted like catfish.
I do not eat with my eyes. And this is Durham, where I'm waiting for bacon-wrapped seitan, because only here. But listen, one of the other great research you've done is on chefs, particularly in the White House, African-American chefs. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so that came out of research in the Soul Food book that's going to be my next book. Every president of the United States has had an African-American in his kitchen in some capacity as the steward, the head cook, or as an assistant. I've got their stories and their recipes. I've personally identified 150 people so far.
I think Barack Obama broke ground hiring what was considered the first female of color as executive chef. But you say, well, that's only because the term executive chef is new.
Right. Jacqueline Kennedy created that position in 1961. Because before that, they were just called the head cook or chief cook. And the very first cook in the White House was a black woman cooking for the Adams. When this was announced about Christetta Comerford, I didn't want to be a jerk and rain on her parade by just doing this technicality. So technically, she is the first female and person of color to be the executive chef.
Your inbox fill up a little bit. You look at the connection between food and social movements. What do you think food can tell us about some of these changes we've seen?
It makes me hopeful because I believe with a lot of the turmoil and things that we have, food is a way that we can reconcile because everybody has to eat. And often food is the easiest way to relate to someone else, food, music, and other things. And I think if we come to the table together, we can really affect change. And you see the role that food played in the civil rights movement and other things, because when people need to gird up that strength to do the fight for social justice or whatever, they often fall back on these comfort foods to sustain them.
Was there a moment because you say down south it's just known often as country cooking, and of course when you move north in that migration, yeah, it's comfort food for the first generation, but it's country food for the next generation. Was there a movement away from it and too close an association with country living?
Yeah, so you have a culture clash as these rural immigrants move to the cities, you know, so people thought of it as backwards. Mm. I think that planted a lot of the seeds that sprouted today in terms of a negative perception of soul food, that it's not modern cuisine and other things like that. But, you know, these things ebb and flow. So right. You start to see a return to this in heritage cooking and other things. But, yeah, you see so many letters in black newspapers over the years complaining about the smells from, you know, the country bumpkin down the hall as they were cooking greens or whatever.
Adrian, great stuff. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Adrian Miller is the author of Soul Foods, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. And you can find out more about the book, Soul Food, at our website, stateofthings.org. From soul food to soul music, the chamber soul of Shauna Tucker coming up. Stay tuned.